May it please the court, counsel. I'm Julie Schutz. I represent the plaintiff, Ronald Heeman. Mr. Heeman applied for Social Security benefits on the basis of his disability stemming from failed back syndrome and major depressive disorder. The ALJ's decision and the appeals counsel's decision not to grant Ronald benefit is not supported by the substantial evidence for numerous reasons. I'd like to touch on the biggest ones. First, the evaluation of the objective medical evidence. Most of the ALJ's decision and the district court's decision hones in on one statement by a Dr. Fortin that there was a paucity of objective findings.
Did any of the examining doctors conclude that his depression would render him incapable of even unskilled work?
None of his mental health professionals made any sort of evaluation like that, but they did assign GAF scores, consistent GAF scores of 45 to 50, although I'll acknowledge later on he was, after a lot of treatment, he was getting some in the 60s. But a GAF score of 45 to 50 is basically saying that there is no ability to function in the workplace. So while no one did an actual mental health assessment, they were giving these GAF scores that would indicate an inability to do any sort of unskilled labor based just on his mental health condition.
So I have a question, which is whether anyone ever tied together his depression with his ability to tolerate pain, because, just in general, one of the things that happens if you read websites and so on, is people who are depressed sometimes are not as capable of withstanding pain.
Right. And I think that through his mental health treatment, they talk a whole lot, pretty much every time, as the commissioner acknowledges, it's always about his pain in conjunction with his sadness and his inability to function. In fact, the fact that he cuts himself with razors for a period of time indicates that he's dealing both with the pain issue and obviously some pretty severe depression issues. So I don't know that anybody specifically made some statement connecting them up, but I think if you read through all the mental health treatment notes, you can see that the pain and the trouble functioning are really interwoven. And
so he isn't somebody who just says, I have pain and there's no physical basis. It's a more subtle point the ALJ is making, which is that I don't see why you would have this much pain from the various back problems that he has.
Right. The ALJ focuses on basically this one doctor statement and an MRI that I acknowledge does not show a whole lot of objective basis. But we're talking about a failed back syndrome case where basically you had back surgery and you're still experiencing pain and there's nothing they can really connect it to or tell you why. They can't do any other surgeries. So we have to look at how he was treating his pain and how credible he is based on his treatment at that point. Because it's with a failed back syndrome case, you're just not going to see a whole lot of objective evidence, and you're not going to see a whole lot in the way of, there's no surgical options.
So would you characterize this then as in that group of cases where the task of the ALJ is to assess the genuineness of the pain? I mean, we have plenty of cases where we say pain is real, even
right,
if it's hard to pin down.
Right. Yeah, I think you have to look at a credibility analysis. In this case, there's so much evidence of how credible he is because of his treatment history, because of the fact that he's cutting himself physically due to the pain.
Is there any evidence in the medical records that would support a contention that he attempted suicide in the past, such as emergency room visits?
There are no emergency room visits for mental health reasons. There are emergency room visits only for pain issues.
So nothing
that's saying they were connected to suicide attempts. I think what happened, a lot of his physicians saw these cutting incidents where he's cutting his forearms and wrists and concluded that it was a suicide-type attempt. But there is nothing in the record saying that that was his intention. But it's clear that this was a way he was dealing with his pain, his very chronic and real pain, that he tried physical therapy for, he tried injections for, a spinal stimulator for. He pretty much did everything you could possibly do for somebody who has back pain that cannot surgically be corrected. And his treating physicians, the one he was with the longest, Dr. Roberts, said on multiple times, I think you're disabled. I think you should apply for disability. I don't think you can work because of your levels of pain. And we have in his mental health treatment notes them saying, I don't understand why he's not on disability. His pain levels are so great. His education is so low. His depression is so bad. We have everybody who meets this man in a face-to-face says, this guy's disabled. All the commissioner can point to is a reviewing doctor who looked in 2005, 2.5 years before the hearing, at his file and said, well, his MRI doesn't show anything, so I think he can do light work, which is contrary to even the work restrictions his doctors gave him when he was first injured that said he can't even lift 10 pounds. So you have to look at the entire record, and when you look at everything and all of his treatment and everything together, it's pretty clear that this is a credible claim for pain, and he's credible in both his saying he's in pain and he's depressed and unable to work. I think even if you look at their consultative examination with that the Social Security sent him to for psychological reasons, he said, well, I would even say because of his pain, his preoccupation with pain, he couldn't work more than 5 hours a day. Well, that doesn't raise to the level of substantial gainful employment. So everybody you have that's meeting this man face-to-face and treating this man agrees that he's in pain and unable to work.
Does the record show when his wife drove him to the hearing, they stopped twice, what they were doing during those stops?
I don't believe it says what they were doing, no. I think the question was just how many times did he have to stop on the way to the hearing.
We don't know if he was lying down or walking around.
No.
Or
we don't
having
know,
a cup of coffee. Or,
we don't know what he was doing, and we don't know what he was doing when he was leaving. Again, this is just the judge making assumptions, which I believe are incorrect, saying that, well, he drove to a hearing, sat through a hearing, and drove back. So clearly he can work because he could sit for 3 hours, which is not what he said. And he also said he needs to sit and lie down after a certain period of time. But when you're looking at just the hearing date, well, people can do something one day. They can go to a hearing one day and then go home and be in complete and utter agony and pain but not be able to do it the next day. So just because you can drive to a hearing, sit through a hearing, which he didn't even sit through. If you look at the record, he was up and down, and then drive home, that doesn't mean that he doesn't need to, on a regular basis, alternate between sitting, standing, and laying. So I don't think that's a fair credibility assessment either. Pretty much everything the ALG points to when you're looking at the credibility assessment, none of it really goes to the heart of the fact that he is credible in his description of his pain, and he's credible in his description of his depression. He's had the treatment. He has all his treating doctors supporting him. So it's just...
And how many doctors were there who supported him?
Dr. Roberts, his primary care physician. Mm-hmm. And he, on three different bases, has said that. And while Dr. Fortin and Dr. Narlar, his pain specialist, they didn't really give an opinion one way or the other, but they continued treating him with the epidural shots, the spinal stimulators.
There's also this mysterious Dr. Holt, who we don't have.
Right. Dr. Holt was some sort of physician that must have been right when he first was injured, and all we know is he had some contact with him, but then he switched. So.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Ms. Steiner?
Good morning. Rachel Steiner on behalf of the Commissioner of Social Security. May it please the Court. As the District Court found, substantial evidence supports the ALJ decision, and it should be affirmed.
So I'm troubled by this case, though, because it seems to me that the Commissioner's position essentially is that pain isn't real unless there's a physical picture or something, a physical basis for it. And, of course, that's not the law. Pain can be real even if it's difficult to tie it down to a particular disc that's slipped or a particular vertebrae that has arthritis on it or a particular point. So how do we get away from this pain isn't real idea?
I don't think that the ALJ decision reflects reflects the finding that pain isn't real if you can't see it. It reflects consideration of a number of factors, one of which was objective evidence, but also a number of other factors. And I think plaintiff suggests that with each of the credibility findings, you know, each one was equivalent to a determination, the plaintiff can work. It was the culmination of all those factors together that led to the conclusion that on the whole, the claimed degree of limitation was not borne out by the record.
Yeah, I mean, because another troublesome thing that's reminiscent of many of our earlier cases in this area is, you know, he is asserting, of course, that he has pain. And one of the things we look for is whether he's just kind of keeping that to himself or whether he's seeking medical assistance. And he certainly does seem to have persuaded quite a few doctors over quite a long period of time that he's suffering from a lot of pain. He gets these four epidural treatments. He gets, you know, the experimental, unsuccessful experiment with the spinal stimulator. He gets this, he gets that, he gets medication, his list as long as your arm. So there are a lot of doctors who are working hard to address this pain, and I don't get the sense that the ALJ thinks that he's snookering these people, that there isn't really pain there. How does the ALJ deal with the fact that there's this consistent medical effort?
The ALJ's decision does indicate that he acknowledged that there were various treatments for pain, none of which ultimately resulted in alleviating the pain.
Right, and I guess what I'm saying is if there are that many treatments, isn't that corroboration that he subjectively is experiencing a great deal of pain, that these medical professionals who, you know, no reason to assume they aren't acting in good faith, are doing their best, although ultimately unsuccessful, doing their best to alleviate?
Well, it corroborates that he's experiencing pain, but what's not evident is the degree of functional limitation from that.
And that's a fair point. And I guess one inference the ALJ draws that troubled me was the ALJ said, well, he obviously has no problems with concentration because he can drive. But actually, he's only driving 10 miles a week, which by my math, you know, is less than one-mile trip out and back per day in a car. In other words, very, very little time behind, at least compared to me, a very, very little time behind the wheel of a car. I unfortunately have to commute in from the suburbs. But I'm not sure whether an inference that somebody's driving 10 miles in a week tells you much about concentration. It strikes me as an extremely small amount of driving. I guess he's just driving to school to pick up his children, except for those days when he's locked himself in the bathroom and is crying.
And right? Again, I think it was among other factors that were considered in terms of concentration.
But, you know, if we keep peeling off these factors, though, at some point the totality is a totality of what?
Well, here's a factor. didn't the ALJ err in discrediting the claims that he was suicidal in light of corroborating evidence? You know, both Dr. Narla and Dr. Robert thought that, you know, they wouldn't prescribe narcotic pain medication because of what they called suicidal events and the suicide attempt. I mean, doesn't that kind of give you a bit of a pause?
Well, I think those medical treatment records are at odds with the mental health treatment records, which do show complaints of suicidal ideation on occasion. They seem particularly linked to pain, in fact, but they don't actually evince these elusive attempts that are referred to in those records. And they also show that he repeatedly denied that he would act on it. He declined to, although encouraged to pursue some sort of inpatient treatment, he repeatedly declined to do that as well. And as far as counsel had referred to episodes of cutting, although that is borne out by earlier in the record, that behavior ceased sometime prior to August 2006. So although there are these somewhat alarming statements in the physical records, they're not borne out by the degree of limitation assessed by the mental health providers.
But it's a preventive measure that the physical doctors are doing. Rather than prescribe him a powerful narcotic that he could just down the whole bottle and finish himself off, they're giving him a form of medication that he can't abuse. That's what they're doing. At least that's what they say they're doing.
So. I believe that's what the record indicates they say they're doing.
Yeah,
I don't know that that's necessarily
so. Given if the prevention has worked, then the mental health people wouldn't have attempts to evaluate.
Well, I don't know that that's fair to say. I think that he went to his mental health treaters, and he also, as I think both sides acknowledge, the bulk of those records focused on pain complaints.
Didn't the ALJ also make a mistake about his emergency room visits? He actually had. I was counting them. I came up with about four, but maybe there are more. The ALJ thought that he hadn't been to the emergency room.
Yeah, there's some amount. I mean, that's an incorrect statement.
Right.
There's some amount. I think it's less than a handful. Some of the ones that plaintiff focuses on are not part of the administrative record. But any error is harmless given the other factors considered. And considering that, plaintiff alleged pain on the order of a 10 out of 10, something like 20 days a month, that's a very infrequent number of visits to the emergency room for pain, if he's experiencing that degree of pain. In the mental health treatment records, it also indicates that his doctors encouraged him to seek emergent treatment for pain, and he repeatedly declined to do so.
Okay.
The court has no further questions. I'll ask that the court affirm the commissioner's decision. Thank you.
Thank you.
Shoot.
I just wanted to make one quick point about the ER visits. First of all, the ALJ, as you said, didn't mention the ER visits at all. And the commissioner argues, well, the fact that he didn't go to the ER so frequently, that shows he's not having pain. Well, he wasn't at the ER because he was at his doctor. He was at his pain specialist. He was at his mental health therapist. He has mental health therapy at least four times a month most months. So I think the fact that he wasn't at the ER is because he was with other doctors. So I think if you look at the case as a whole, this is the classic pain case where he has done everything he can to try to alleviate his pain. And you have got to acknowledge that he's credible when you look at all the treatment and everything he's going through. And so as a classic pain case, I think this is one where we have to say it needs to be at least remanded to reevaluate for credibility reasons, because this ALJ did a poor job of the credibility evaluations. So we ask that you please remand this case. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.